I want to welcome everyone today. Welcome everyone on our journey in community and fellowship. And as part of that, we welcome this morning the Reverend Dr. Ken Reeves. Ken is a UU minister who's led congregations in Ohio, Delaware. He has a doctorate in psychology and a therapy practice in Massachusetts, as well as leads working groups in clergy assessments, and teaches, too, at Andover Newton on conflict resolution. I hope you all have a nice morning, and please join me in welcoming Reverend Dr. Ken Reeves.
May peace be in your hearts. Through the energy of freedom and the warmth of love, may you live the fullness of being alive, and in that fullness find peace. Through justice and understanding, may humanity be at peace, and may all of life on earth live together in balance and peace. It's good to be with you all this morning. Thank you, Will. Thanks, Kendra, for inviting me. I want to extend a welcome to anyone who, like me, is visiting here for the first time. I think it takes some courage to enter the doors of an unfamiliar congregation, and so I extend my welcome and applaud your courage. And if I were to introduce this congregation to our visitors, I might hazard to guess that, like other Unitarian Universalist congregations, we are a support community for people on various journeys towards ultimate goals, such as union or liberation or peace. And one of the ways we support each other is by attending to how we get along. This comes from our tradition. Some 400 years ago, our earliest forebears, Unitarians in Transylvania, did discuss and debate the nature of the divine. Is it three parts, unity? But the people in the congregations were interested in how to get along. And our earliest forebears, about the same time in Poland, founded cities in which they included the Beatitudes of Jesus in the city charters, hoping to influence ethics with the words of Jesus. And this tradition continues through to today. You can see it in our Unitarian Universalist purposes and principles, which affirm the democratic process, or caring and compassion in human relationships, or a goal of world community and peace. And that's what today's service is about. It's about getting along, and particularly getting along when getting along is difficult, which is in a conflict. I offer this service out of my caring for you and my desire to support you in all of your relationships. I hope that in your relationships you find love and its warmth and freedom and its energy and live the full richness of being alive.
My reading this morning is about conflict. It comes from Zen Buddhism. A big, fierce samurai once addressed a little monk. "Monk," he bellowed, accustomed to instant obedience, "teach me about heaven and hell." The monk looked up at this warrior with disdain. "Teach you about heaven and hell? I can't teach you anything. You're filthy. You smell. Your blade is rusty. You're an embarrassment to the samurai class." The samurai shook with fury. Red in the face, speechless with rage, he unsheathed his sword and raised it above him, preparing to smite the monk. "This is hell," the monk said softly. The samurai stopped and looked down at the little monk, touched by the compassion and surrender of this man who had offered to give his life to teach about hell. The samurai lowered his sword, filled with gratitude and peace. "And this is heaven," said the monk. Well, conflicts are very difficult things and very serious and painful. People in a conflict have powerfully painful emotions. And I've asked Mary, and I guess Mary has asked Rob, to have a piece of music that reflects the angst and pain that goes on in a conflict. So thank you. I do not enjoy conflicts. Although when I'm in one, I'm consumed by a manic glee, plotting how to win and dominate, how to cause my opponent to slink away with their tail between their legs, as they deserve. When I stop trying to win, though, the conflict goes well. Indeed, a conflict handled well results in a wise agreement and a stronger relationship. In so doing, the conflict addresses and changes inhumane structures and assumptions in the relationship. Assumptions like there has to be a winner and a loser, a dominant party and a subordinate, and that my opponent has to be defeated. Conflict begins with a difference, and you and I are different, which sets up a conflict. A conflict can escalate, of course, and become increasingly painful. Some such conflicts go on for hours, years, or centuries, marked by slamming doors and furious walks into the night, alcohol, and talk radio. But a rift does not have to persist forever. Ideally, a conflict runs a course from harmony to rift to return to harmony. And having a course, conflicts go through stages. I think there are four. Stage one, the honeymoon, or pseudo-harmony. This harmony is based on the participants ignoring their differences with each other and being happy. This stage can last from a few moments to lifetimes. I know of marriages in which one partner gives up his or her, often her, identity and adopts a peace at any price stance to avoid attention to any difference with their spouse. The price of such peace can include anxiety, depression, somatic symptoms, and boredom, but it does avoid tension. In the Zen story, the samurai expects stage one. A typical subordinate would bow and scrape to the samurai. The monk should offer a meek little homily about heaven and hell and hope the samurai goes away. Our monk did not. And move the process to stage two, the pressure stage. At stage two, the differences become apparent and cause discomfort, to which the participants respond by pressuring the other to change. The message is, I'm uncomfortable, you change. I'm in pain, you fix it. I'm right, you're wrong. The other often replies with, now I'm uncomfortable, you change. as they pressure each other, people engage in the game of the one who applies the most pressure wins. Raised voices, put-downs, violence, and war occur at this stage. The monk does stage two with his derision of the samurai. I'm uncomfortable with your smell, your armor. You change. The samurai does stage two as he prepares to smite the monk. I'm uncomfortable with your effrontery. You change by ceasing to live. We are not clones of each other, and so we have differences. I could respond to a difference with, no problem. You say tomato, I say tomato. Okay. But often I can't handle differences. Indeed, at stage two, differences fill the air. I feel tense, and I want only one pronunciation of tomato. That's tomato. What makes differences difficult is one of the ways the world is organized. That is, as a survival of the fittest hierarchy. In this system, organisms compete to survive and pass along their genes. And so among a litter of pups, the most robust will push aside the weaker for access to mother's milk. Or two male elk clashing antlers in the mountains are working out who is most fit to pass on his genes to the waiting harem of females. It is tough, but the survival of the fittest offers a benefit, which is species vitality. Humans, too, live by the survival of the fittest organization. As we set up hierarchies and dominant and subordinate structures, so dominant parties, kings, and aristocrats rule subordinate serfs or slaves. Some religions have a hierarchy in which they have the saved with correct beliefs superior to those who have incorrect beliefs. Economically, the most fit are the richest. Men can dominate women. Adults dominate children. People dominate nature. And nations wage war in a survival of the fittest drama. In that survival of the fittest world, the person who is different from me poses a threat because they could be better than me. If they are better, my flaws are revealed, and if I am flawed and not as fit to survive, my existence is threatened. When differences raise a threat to my survival, I feel fear, anger, and shame. Shame is particularly painful. I mean, shame occurs when one's flaws are exposed and there's nothing I can do to unflaw myself, and I'm helpless and exposed as less fit for survival. When differences threaten to expose my flaws, like somebody could be better than me, I protect myself by erasing the difference. Like, you all agree with me on that point, don't you? Or by making myself the superior one, because I'm right. Or by trying to ignore or pay any attention to any difference. Put-downs of others, alcohol abuse, and war comprise other destructive and self-destructive lengths people can take to hide their flaws and avoid moving down in the survival of the fittest hierarchy. Although I think no one has actually died of shame, I think plenty of people have escalated conflicts, killed and died to protect themselves from flaws and shame. For instance, our samurai. When the monk exposed his flaws, the samurai threatens to kill the monk. So, at stage two of a conflict, I hide my flaws, protected behind a castle wall, lobbing bombs at my perceived opponent, pointing out their flaws, who hides in their castle, lobbing bombs at me. And the structure of one up, one down relating persists. We just don't know who is going to end up up. People can assume conflict consists only of stage two and stay there for a long time. Ideally, though, stage two becomes tiring. People weary of war. Stage two is hell. War is hell, and matters do not improve despite vigorous applications of pressure. I can also feel alone and lonely. Like if I have a rift with my wife, I miss her, which prompts me to do something I fear, become open and vulnerable, and move to stage three, the vulnerability and curiosity stage. At stage three, I recognize that my efforts to or attempts to pressure the other to change have failed, and so I give them up. I shift to speaking vulnerably about what's going on within me, such as my share of the problem, and to curiosity about the other, like how can I understand you better? I can feel uncomfortable with this vulnerability and maybe flaws exposed, but relieved to end the back and forth attacks. Like if stage two involves two parties within their castles lobbing bombs at each other, stage three involves coming out from behind the stone walls, open and vulnerable, and you can see me now. Every cell in my body resists, but I do it. The monk shows himself at stage three by sitting vulnerable as the samurai raises his sword and simply telling the samurai, this is hell. Our monk has great faith in stage three. The samurai shows himself at stage three when he views the monk with compassion and lowers his sword. Stage three involves a lot of risk, but the hope is that through stage three, or through this risk, I can gain what I most want in life, which is to be myself and to be close to someone else. It's easy when I'm alone to be myself. It's easy in relationship to be who the other pressures me to be, but I want to be myself in relationship. And to be myself and be close requires letting myself be known, vulnerable, and exposed. It is scary not to protect myself. I hope the eye beholding my vulnerability will look at me with acceptance, as did the samurai lowering his sword and gazing at the monk. If that happens, my risk is rewarded, and I can be myself in relation to someone else. And at stage three, you too can be yourself. I no longer pressure my opponent to be who I want them to be, but look at them with acceptance and listen to their truth. And if we both speak the truth that lives in our hearts, the walls that separate us disappear, a bridge spans our rift, and we meet. Stage three, vulnerability and curiosity. Move us to stage four, peace. This is heaven. Stage four harmony differs from stage one pseudo-harmony because with our differences exposed, we know each other well, and still we meet. Sometimes we can settle on a win-win solution that solves our problem and improves the relationship. We can, for example, brainstorm how to say tomato, tomato. Deciding on tomato Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Tomato Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. And on Sunday, it shall be the vegetable whose name shall not be spoken. Or the two may not find a solution to their conflict, but still find peace with a deeper mutual understanding. They go with the question of, okay, we have a difference. What can we both feel good about now? don't have to agree on all the things that we're talking about, but what can we find that we both like? I'd say stages one and its avoidance of conflict, and stage two and its pressure follow survival of the fittest logic. Stage one assumes there has to be a winner and a loser, and not wanting that avoids battle, opting, again, peace at any price. Stage two plays on that winner-loser logic with a vengeance. I am going to win at any price. But stages three and four are based on the other way the world is organized. That is, we are in this together, and we survive by cooperating and collaborating. In this logic, we all have flaws, and so what? In this logic, we find win-win solutions. Indeed, we win by relating one unique self in relation to another unique self. I am myself, you are yourself, you're not my enemy, and we are close. Just as nature has the survival of the fittest organization, it also has the we're in this together organization. Cells collect to form bodies, animals congregate into communities, and the aggregate of all the species in the world form a we're in this together association. In human circles, the we're in this together theme involves respect for the worth of everyone, salvation for all, fairness, a value for nature, an ethics based on interconnectedness and responsibility, differences addressed with listening, conflicts handled with negotiation, and peace. And instead of winners and losers, everyone wins. I think every conflict involves a dance between the survival of the fittest and its logic, and we're in this together and its logic. I suspect these two themes have characterized life since its creation. I mean, protoplasm competed with protoplasm for survival, and protoplasm congregated and worked together. Tonight's living room conflict over who holds the remote echoes the dance of winning and losing, working together, that began at the origin of life. And whenever we go to stages three and four in a conflict and relate by the we're in this together structure, we dismantle the inhumane structure of winner, loser, dominant, subordinate. Conflicts and rifts and wars continue, but I think humanity is learning to move through the stages to harmony and peace. I note that during prehistoric times, one in four people died by violence. During our Civil War, one in 50 Americans died. Now less than 1/10,000th of humanity dies in war. In 1990, 38 armed conflicts were being fought around the world. In 2004, there were 20. Although by 2012, there were 27. Still, some nations are learning to settle disputes nonviolently, learning stages three and four. And individuals are learning, at least I'm learning, to talk through problems. And my daughter at age 7 is coming up with win-win solutions and compromises. I find something spiritual in moving through a conflict. I mean, stage two is a self-aggrandizing stage, and I am so superior and unflawed, but the spirit recoils from self-aggrandizement and beckons me to stage three. Spirituality invites me to be vulnerable and curious during a conflict by offering the concept of redemption. Redemption teaches that in spite of imperfections, you are okay. In Christian terms, God loves you. Hindus say that at your innermost core, Atman, you are God, Brahman. Universalists teach that everyone is saved. And though you've broken your vows 1,000 times, you're still included. I'd like to place a little spiritual guide on everyone's shoulder. Who in the midst of a rift would say, this person may be mad at you, but trust redemption. You're a miracle of life. Curiously enough, God is involved as well. Paralleling the human move away from war, God has become more of a peacemaker. In ancient times, one people's God would be their ally against another people and their God. These gods would wage gory battles and slay and slaughter enemy gods and despise people. I mean, God was an ultimate weapon or a blessing for violence. But through history, when tolerance toward a neighbor supported trade and that supported prosperity, God helped by making peace with that neighbor and their God. So while once Yahweh invited Israel to plunder the enemy Moabites, in the later book of Ruth, God welcomes Ruth, the Moabite, into a loving Hebrew community. Or in the book of Ezekiel, God helped make Assyria suffer, as its wickedness deserves. In the later written book of Jonah, God shows compassion for the Assyrians. In Hebrew scriptures, God further moves from caring for one nation, such as Israel, to caring for all nations. As a benediction for this evolution, God offers Noah, after the flood, a rainbow as a sign of, quote, an everlasting covenant between God and every living creature. Jesus, appearing later in history, furthers this theme of peacemaking by offering that most difficult teaching, love your enemy. A stage 3 statement. And when I love my enemy, they're no longer my enemy. And lo, stage 4, I'm at peace with them. But how to do this difficult thing? If we continue with Judeo-Christian scriptures, Paul offers a clue when he writes in his letter to the Romans that we are all loved and redeemed by God. He speaks not for a survival of the spiritually fittest order with spiritual winners and losers, but a we are all saved together order. Therefore, in the ultimate spiritual world, I do not have to worry about being one up or one down, winning or losing, which means differences do not have to alarm me. I mean, if we're all redeemed, tomato, tomato, I can handle either one. If God can move through the stages of conflict and make peace, and if I belong in a redeeming and thereby safe spiritual home, then maybe I can resolve my conflicts. I know the mending of a rift as a risky softening. I let go of my need to be right, confess a vulnerable truth, and accept another human being. The actual mending does not take long. A peace offering, an appreciation of my partner's value, their acceptance of me, which surprises me, and the reconciliation, the union I enjoy with my former enemy, suffuses me with lightness and peace. This is heaven.